The first half an hour is quite tense. These townsfolk, they don't like them. The one guy's like, should be like, oh, you got pink hair? Do you know who else got pink hair? Satan. Like I was expecting to say that, like, they're at the bar and he keeps coming back. He's like, what do you say to me, honey? You got a degree? And she's like, yeah, I'm actually a doctor. And she's like, a woman doctor? That's Satan. Hello and welcome to the Dan and Joe Film Show, episode 34. Hope you're well and staying safe. If I sound a lot better, it's because I've got my lovely microphone picking up all the nice qualities of my voice. You are welcome. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime. I like to call him Joseph and the podcast messiah. It's Joe Richards!
The podcast messiah.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that. It's always nice being compared to the Messiah, though, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. And it's lovely to have you back on your mic. So tell the listeners what the story is behind this, because they might have listened. You know, we've got devoted listeners. Yeah. The past few weeks, we've had nothing but complaints about your audio on the show. So maybe give those angry listeners an explanation as to why you haven't had my microphone as you usually do over the past couple of episodes.
It was a big news story, actually. It was up there with, like, the cases at the minute and, you know, COVID cases. It was a really big story. I couldn't believe it. And thankfully, C has taken off the load now and they're kind of angry at her. So thank goodness for that. But yeah, the last couple of weeks, well, let's just say thicker is better, is all I can say on that matter, because basically, I was using my dad's laptop, which was a MacBook Air, okay? And if you kind of get the name of the Air, it's very thin. It's crispy. It's like just like a little crisp. Yeah, it's just like a little crisp. It's as thin as a crisp. Very thin. But the reason is that I couldn't plug my microphone into it because it's so thin, you see?
Yeah.
So sometimes thin isn't always better. I'm using my sister's computer. It's a MacBook Pro, and it's more sturdier. It's thicker. It does the job. It's a little bit older, a little bit dusty. But you know what? It's aged like a fine wine. So this is how it's going to be from now on. I'm going to be committed because, like you said, Joe, you know, we want to give our listeners the best that, you know, they could possibly want. And, you know, if we can just brighten up their day with my voice, then I'm going to do that for them.
Exactly. And I'm sure your sister is over the moon that you're going to be using her laptop going forward for these recordings.
She was like, but I need it. I was like, Rachel, I was like, you just deliver food. And she was like, but I need it for, like, Netflix when I'm on break. And I'm like,
it's not a phone, not good enough, or like,
Joe, I don't know. I think she wants a home cinema at this rate. I mean, what do you really need it for? But she's been very grateful to give it to me, and I will be returning it very soon so she can carry on. But I am getting text messages just from all her work colleagues, like, I'm over in Newport at the minute doing deliveries. Where is everybody? And I feel like I'm just going to text them back during the show and be like, I'm right outside, mate. Where's my food?
Where's my food?
But how are you, mate? How's everything going with you? Obviously, yesterday, good old Mark Drakeford gave the announcement that we're going to be basically in lockdown for another 3 weeks, but hopefully the last 3 weeks. But how do you feel?
Yeah, I feel good about that announcement, to be honest. A bit of a mixed bag. Obviously, he said in the announcement that for the next 3 weeks, the main kind of plan is going to be getting schools reopened, which I think is right. And I'm sure you're very excited for that. And then he said the next 3 weeks after that would be to hopefully open non-essential retail. Now, is cinema going to be included in non-essential retail? I can't see why not. It is essentially a business. I know it's not a shop, but, you know, if people can go into shops and, like, go, you know, and buy clothes and be in Primark and in those little aisles in Primark, why can't people sit in a cinema for 2 hours socially distanced? So fingers crossed, within the next 6 weeks, we should hopefully, I'm praying that we get cinemas reopened. Groups of four people now can meet outside.
It's so mad. That's all good. It's mad. There's going to be so many raves, I tell you what.
So many raves, definitely, in Butte Park and Roath Park. So yeah, so feeling good about that. Feeling good about today. I think we've got a great show lined up. It's a Saturday, and I love recording on a Saturday for some reason. Like, I think maybe because obviously that's when we used to do the radio show. Mm. And there's something nice about recording, I think on a Saturday, and I'm still in my pajamas. It's quite early on a Saturday. It's really rainy outside. So you've got every excuse, especially with lockdown, to just do nothing all day. I've had two coffees already on my Tassimo. And I'm going to, after this now, I'm going to go over the shop, get some nice goodies in for lunch and so on, and then watch RuPaul. But how are you feeling about the whole announcement, and what are you up to on this lovely Saturday?
Well, firstly, I hope you get dressed to go to the supermarket, because nobody needs to see that on a Saturday morning, do they?
They really don't. They really don't.
Although, you know, like, you know what they say about pajama bottoms with the bulge and everything like that? So we'll skip leave that there.
They do say that.
They do say that. All I can say is Doris at Sainsbury's is going to have quite a little look this morning. Yeah, I agree with you. And actually, the more you say that, the more it makes sense, because cinemas are very rare in the sense there's not been a single COVID case at all since the start of this pandemic. But still, they're kind of treated like, oh, you know, they're part of the hospitality sector, which I disagree with. And I think last summer when they opened, I think it was the same as restaurants and pubs at the same time, especially in England. But yeah, I don't see why not. You're right, like Primark is like the worst place to be, you know. They pack them in like sardines. You can barely breathe in there. And yes, you're not like stood in one place for a long period of time, but my opinion, cinemas have done such a good job. I mean, really, you cannot fault them. I don't think it's been a single person, even the worst germophobes, who have been like, oh yeah, it's not, I don't feel safe. They've gone above and beyond, right? They've kind of sacrificed, I would say, a good bit of their business to make sure that people are well socially distanced. All the hygiene protocols are in there. So I don't see why not. Yeah, I'm the same with you. I think shops and I think cinemas have been the lowest. I did see something yesterday. Somebody was like, oh, pubs have caused no cases. I'm like, I don't know about that. Same with schools. But I guess the thing is, what Drake said yesterday was kind of, I agree with him. He said it's not just the data. It's not just the statistics, because schools contributed a lot to the cases. Like, as a teacher, we had year groups going off every couple of days. That's not the case. It's that, right, what are the most important things? And I agree with you. I think they should open schools. They're hoping to open all schools by mid-March. And I think by mid-March, the end of March, I think, I don't see why not. Once they open shops, they should just be like, yeah, open cinemas, open leisure centres and gyms. Because I know, you know you love the gym. Oh, you know, you're a sweaty Betty, aren't you, at the gym? So yeah, I think why not? Like, don't group us in with the pub lot. Like, we're better than that. Mm. So yeah, we'll see what happens. Let's start though, before we get to some this week's new releases, which are great, by the way. We've got four films for you this week. And also, we're really excited to tell you all that we've sat down and chatted with Helen O'Hara. You may know her. She's a film critic, film author, journalist for Empire Magazine. She's just written a new book. It's called Women vs. Hollywood. And we had the pleasure of chatting to her. So you'll be able to listen to that later in the show. First, though, shall we get to some news, Joey? And the first bit of news, obviously, kind of carrying on with trailer reaction, the big trailer this week was Disney's Cruella, which is kind of like a reboot, but, you know, prequel, but looking at the origins of Cruella, how she came to be, her younger years, you know, when she was out partying, you know, with all the dogs and everything like that. Who let the dogs out? Cruella did. And this is played by Emma Stone. It also stars Emma Thompson as well. You've seen the trailer. What did you think of it? Because it has a very kind of gothic style to it. And I can't deny I did turn to my better half when watching it. And I said, oh, it's Harley Quinn. It does give off those vibes, doesn't it?
It does. It definitely gives off those vibes. I'm really excited for it. We've discussed the Disney reboots, remakes aplenty in the past. When we back doing the radio show, we had our good friends Well Good Movies on to discuss The Lion King. And that was a really interesting show because there was just such different views on it. Disney have had a lot of grief in the past for obviously literally just doing shot-for-shot remakes, which The Lion King essentially was. Now, I thought The Lion King is such a great story that the remake didn't really bother me, even though it was essentially a direct, you know, remake shot-by-shot. But this looks like the most interesting kind of reboot remake that they've done to date. You've got Emma Stone leading the cast, and she's just fantastic. She's one of the best actresses working today. Then you've got the visuals, you've got the atmosphere. I think it's set in 1970s London. So you've got all that, those aesthetics, the costumes, the hair, the music. And it looks like a bit darker. Like some people are literally, yeah, like you said about Harley Quinn, people are like, this is going to be the Joker of the Disney remakes. And that's a bit too much. I can't imagine Disney going to have Cruella at the end on a talk show and shoot someone in the head. I can't imagine that's going to happen. I can't imagine it's going to go that dark. But I admire Disney for at least, it looks like they're going to try and do something a little bit different this time around. Whether it's successful or not, we'll wait to see. But I at least it's trying to do something a little bit different. Those are my initial thoughts. What are yours?
Yeah, I agree. I'm really looking forward to this. I think obviously it's a lot darker than what Disney are usually doing. And you're right, even remakes like Mulan, which I didn't care for. Yeah, they changed bits of the original, but I still didn't like, I'm really sick of remakes at this point. You're totally right. And I think if you change too much, fans are not going to be happy. And if you change nothing, fans are not going to be happy. So why not just do an origin story? And this is what they've done here. Interestingly, it is due for a cinema release date on the 28th of May. I think it will keep at the cinemas because I'm kind of seeing where Disney are at the minute, why they're keeping things like Black Widow and Cruella in cinemas. I think they're saving the more, not darker, but more kind of more adult films, more films that are 12A, I think they're going to push for cinema because if you look at films like Mulan and Ray and the Last Dragon, which is due to come out, obviously they're going straight to Disney Plus. They are more family orientated films. I don't see people paying £20 for Cruella. Maybe I'm wrong. Same with the New Mutants. That's the reason why they didn't put that on Disney Plus. They're saving these films because I do think they reach a larger audience in the cinema. And I will 100% go watch in the cinema. I think it's really good. And yeah, Emma Stone is just great. Like she's just every project she does. I was watching Zombieland 2 the other day and I forgot like how good that was and how good she is in it. You know, she's so professional and so versatile as an actress. So I love her as well. I think she's great. And again, yeah, you know, there was a bit of Harley Quinn in there, but we've had so much Harley Quinn that it's so hard not to kind of, you know, if anything looks like edgy, gothic, you know, it just automatically becomes Harley Quinn. But you're right. Yeah. I hope she doesn't, you know, kill anybody because I will not be happy.
Especially if they're dogs. If she kills Dalmatians, I will be human.
From the very beginning, I realized I saw the world differently than everyone else. That didn't sit well with some people. But I wasn't for everyone. I guess they were always scared that I'd be a psycho. But a new day brings new opportunities. And I was ready to make a statement. How does the saying go? I am woman. Hear me roar. I'm just getting started, darling. The thing is, I was born brilliant. Born fast. And a little bit mad. I'm Cruella. No.
Another big news stories this week, and I know you're particularly happy about this one.
Yes.
Paddington 3 is in the works. It's in development. And you are a massive fan of both Paddington films, aren't you? I remember, didn't you give both of them 5-star? Like, yeah. You love them.
Yeah, yeah. Both 5-star films for me. I just think they're so nice. They're so lovely. And we did a post when it was announced late on Thursday that it was officially in production. And it's been a while since Paddington 2 as well. And for a little bit of time, I've been like, you know, why? What's going on with Paddington 3? They haven't officially announced it. So to have that news, I think like you could feel the whole world breathe a sigh of relief. Like on Twitter, on social media, people were just over the moon that we are going to get a Paddington 3 film. And hopefully it will come, you know, not too long after this is all over. And I think it's just the type of film that we will need in the world once this is all over. Because I think right now, the world in general, everybody's very tense. Everybody's getting a bit snappy. all the people I talk to every day in my job, especially. I think we're all in that place now where we're a bit fed up. We've had enough. And I think when we come out of this, it's going to take a little while for us to finally get back to how we were. I think we're still going to, it's going to change the people's attitudes and the way we act day to day. So I think for Paddington 3 to be in the works, which is no doubt, just if it's anything like the first two films, just going to be lovely and all about, you know, being nice to people and welcoming different communities and bringing different cultures together. I think that is going to be a film that we are going to really, really need by the time we come out of all of this. But how are you feeling about it? Are you excited?
Well, shock horror, I haven't seen the first one.
Get out of here.
I've only seen the second one. I've really enjoyed it. And you're right, it was fluffy, it was cute, it was heartwarming, it was everything you wanted. It has that kind of British nostalgic feel to it. You had Hugh Grant, who was just great.
I love him.
So hopefully they bring all the cast back for the third film, like Sally Hawkins and Hugh Bonneville, all those. I think they're great. But yeah, it could be the perfect trilogy. Like, if they nail this one,
this could
be untouchable. Because very rarely we have a trilogy which are like all five stars. So if it isn't a five star, Joe, that's going to be awful.
I have faith. I don't know why, but I just have faith because they've just got such a talented team of writers on there from the first two films, which just get the balance right between the comedy and like the heart of it. I remember Paddington 2, actually, I stuck it on over Christmas because it was on BBC One, I think. And I'd forgotten the ending and I turned it on and I was like, uh-oh, and just floods of tears, just what? Crying. Honestly, that ending when, you know, he answers the door and I won't spoil it for people, just floods of tears, just makes me cry. It's got that perfect balance and I can't wait to see what they do with the next one.
Oh, what's this?
Ah, that must be the popping book. Very interesting.
Really?
You see, Madame Koslova's great-grandmother, who started the fair, was also a brilliant artist. And every time they visited a new city, she made a popping book to remember it by.
Oh.
And this is London.
Oh, Mr. Gruber. It's wonderful. Aunt Lucy always dreamed of coming to London and never had the chance. But if she saw this, it would be like she were finally here.
Aunt Lucy! Aunt Lucy!
Paddington! Oh.
Come with me, Aunt Lucy.
Oh, yes, please. I want to see everything.
Well, what do you think?
It's wonderful.
All aboard.
1.5 bears, please.
Mind your step, madam.
Oh, what a polite young man. What a polite young pigeon. Paddington, you've made an old bear so very happy.
This is perfect.
Shall we move on to some reviews?
Yes, and moving on to something which isn't so cuddly and lovely.
No.
At hey, all.
Yeah. Hey, kids, you like cannibals? Here we go.
We've already talked about remakes, reboots, this show already. This is a remake / reboot of that classic horror franchise, Wrong Turn, which I loved back in the day, I'm not going to lie. If you've ever seen the Wrong Turn films from back in the day, they kind of revolved around a very simple premise of people getting lost in the woods and coming across not-so-friendly hillbilly cannibals, that classic trope of horror cinema. This one follows pretty much the exact same plotline. A group of friends hiking the Appalachian Trail are confronted by the Foundation, a community of people who have lived in the mountains for hundreds of years, and they're not very pleased that these young youths have kind of crossed over into their land. Here's a clip.
How much further? There's a steep trail up along this ridge. Oh, wow, though. It's a bitch of a hike.
But it shortcuts us right up to the bastard's front door.
Cooper! Cooper! Cooper, you hurt?
You all right?
I think I twisted my ankle.
Thank God. Come on, help me pull him out.
Here, give me a hand. Give me the other hand.
So that's a clip there from Wrong Turn, or Wrong Turn, The Foundation, depending on where you see it. And I was excited for this. It kind of came from nowhere. I saw the trailer on YouTube randomly when I was just kind of browsing my phone before bed one night. And I was like, Wrong Turn, I remember that film. Back in the day, me and my mum, we used to have like a Friday night film club. And we used to watch like the trashiest like horror films back in the day when you had to actually physically go out and like rent.
Oh yes, Blockbuster.
Yes. Oh, yes, exactly. Like the big chunky VHS.
Oh,
like,
chunky
cassettes. Mm. Yeah, we watched like Anaconda, Lake Placid.
Oh,
like anything cheesy or like with like a giant animal like killing people, we loved. And I think Wrong Turn came out around that about that time, and I loved it. Like I remember my mum just being in stitches watching it, just because it's such a. Like, I don't know if it's intentional or what, but it's such a funny film, that first film. So I was excited for this, especially when I read about how the filmmakers behind this one wanted to bring a new edge to the film. They wanted to kind of bring it up to the modern day, and they kind of referenced Jordan Peele's Get Out. And when the film starts, I got that. I could see where they were going with that because, you know, we've got this multicultural, diverse cast of young people in the central roles, and they kind of end up in the back end of nowhere. And you've got all these kind of townsfolk who are like, what are you doing here? You know, and you get the impression that they don't like them being there because of the color of the skin. So I thought, okay, this could be interesting. Maybe it is going to make some kind of social commentary on racism down south and things like that. I think the filmmakers, though, are being very generous in saying that they're trying to kind of duplicate Get Out. It doesn't go that far. It doesn't have the same success as something like Jordan Peele's Get Out in kind of drilling home that message. What it does have are quite a lot of surprises, though, nonetheless. I did not know where this film was going to go at all. It does go down a different route. It does go down a different path to the other films, for better or for worse. Without spoiling too much, I did miss the mutant cannibals.
Yeah, we all do. We love them.
I could have done with a bit more mutant cannibals. So the film constantly surprised me. And I think it's got a really neat idea as well in like kind of telling two separate narratives, because you've got this back and forth between, you know, these children running around in the woods being chased by these people in giant skull masks. And then you've got a storyline set a few weeks later where the lead actress's father is basically trying to find the kids and find out what's going on. And I liked that idea. I thought that was quite neat. And it did constantly keep me surprised as to what was going on. I think it lags a lot in the middle. The first half is kind of them running around in the woods, kind of being dispatched in classic Wrong Turn ways. Then you find out sort of what's going on. And then I felt a little bit deflated. I felt like it lagged for about 20 minutes with the exposition, like, we are the foundation. This is what we do. And then it kind of brought it back in the last act, very tense, atmospheric. There's a scene where they're like walking through a cave and there's all these people with like burnt out eyes, and that was really effective. Mm. And then you've got the final ending, which left me infuriated. I was like, what? I was like, this is going to drive me mad if this is the ending of the film. And then something again happens in the credits, which I was like, oh, brilliant, brilliant. That saved it for me. That saved it for me there. So fair play to the film. It played with my emotions. You could tell I was invested because I was getting so worked up by the end of it that if it didn't go the way I wanted it to, I would have been very, very angry. So I think for the filmmakers to say it's, you know, something, you know, kind of groundbreaking, akin to Jordan Peele's Get Out, that it's not that. But what it is a successful kind of reboot. I think it's tense. It's full of surprises. Didn't go down the way that I thought it was going to go. And I thought overall, a decent Saturday night horror film. What did you think?
I agree. I've seen every single Wrong Turn film. I love them. Give me some mutant cannibalism any day. And what I love about the series is that they're just so goofy and so tongue-in-cheek.
Yes,
yes. The second film, there's a scene where he takes an axe and he cuts like a guy in half, like completely in half, like symmetrical. And then he just like falls, both sides go down. It's disgusting. You know, I had a very crazy childhood. It was like, oh, why are you watching? Oh, I watched Recess. So what did you watch? I watched The Wrong Turn 2. obviously, when I heard they were doing a remake, I was like, what is the point? But apparently they had a very different vision for it. Mm. It was going to be a lot darker, a lot gorier. And it was going to go in and really tap into some really interesting ideas about the whole cult aspect of it, of these people that are living in this forest. And they're not like goofy mutant cannibals. They are very much different, very much Midsummer vibes, isn't it? Yes, I feel like everyone's cashing in on that right now, which I thought was really interesting. But you're right, like the first half an hour is quite tense. These townsfolk, they don't like them. The one guy's like, should be like, oh, you got pink hair? Do you know who else got pink hair? Satan. like I was expecting to say that, like they're at the bar and he keeps coming back. He's like, what do you say to me, honey? You got a degree? And she's like, yeah, I'm actually a doctor. And she's like, a woman doctor? That's Satan. like that, it's honestly, I don't know where they went, but I feel like there's not even a place that, you know, that backwards. But anyway, I'm with you. I thought the first half an hour, 40 minutes was okay. I was like, oh, well, you know, we're kind of delving into familiar territory. They put all these traps in the forest. People die in very gruesome ways. And again, I think they're really pushing for like, oh, we need to be like, have a social commentary. You know, there's a gay couple in the film, which I was like, great. And then that kind of get cut short so quickly. And I'm like, and then, yeah, again, this whole thing of like, you know, interracial couples. And like, again, that wasn't really touched upon. So again, I feel like it laid the groundwork, but didn't do anything to push it. The middle act for me, I really enjoyed actually. And I found it very unpredictable. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I was not expecting this at all. And I, the way it climaxes, without spoiling it, like the dad in the film is so cool. I loved him so much. he's so, you know, just awesome. And I was loving it. And then the last 5 minutes happened. And I just was so disappointed. I just thought, I feel like I've seen this ending so many times before. It does the thing where she imagines something happening and they're like, honey, are you okay? Oh, it's just, I really hated it, the ending. I really did. And I get what you mean about the credits. Even that, for me, I was like, oh, not needed. I was like, are they trying to cash in on another one? I was so disappointed. I was like, oh, if they just left it at a certain point, it literally would have been an extra star for me. And that I never say that normally. But so, yeah, I enjoyed it. I think it's a different vision. It taps into some really interesting ideas. People say it's gorier. I don't know whether it's gorier. I think it's more disturbing. You're right about the whole, you know, she's walking toward this cave and all people haven't got eyes in them. That's very disturbing. But yeah, shame about the ending. You know, people just want too much and they get caught up, you know. But it
was interesting, though, what you said. He basically deducted a star. Mm. I was very close to doing the same thing with that ending.
You're more generous.
When I sat there and watched the credits, I was like, please, 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 something else happen. And then something does happen. So do stick around for the end credits, because obviously you'll miss an important plot point if you just turn it off as soon as the credits start. That sort of saved it for me. But it's interesting because I was very close to doing the same, deducting a point. But I thought it was decent and I was quite surprised by it. I thought it was quite a successful reboot. Would I want more? I'm not too sure. Bring back the kind of hillbilly cannibals and then we'll take it from there. But it's actually out today, so if you do want to watch it, it's on VOD streaming, available today.
Absolutely brilliant. Moving on now to something very different. I felt like I've had to write an essay on this film. We could spend a whole podcast on this film, I tell
we
you what.
We could.
Maybe one day. This is Music. And this is directed by Sia. You know, Chandelier.
Oh,
she sang that, yeah. Oh,
beautiful.
Thank you so
absolutely
much.
Absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
Well,
and she's got this Australian accent like this. She's so cute. Anyway, so this is her directorial debut. And this stars Kate Hudson, Leslie Odom Jr., Maddie Ziegler. And it's basically a story about a young girl played by Maddie Ziegler. She's a low-functioning girl with autism. She lives with her grandmother. Her grandmother suddenly passes away. And then in comes Kate Hudson's character called Zoo, who is her half-sister. She is a recovering alcoholic. She's a drug dealer. Her life is not on the straight and narrow, and she ends up having to care for music played by Maddie Ziegler. Then you'll have a neighbor played by Leslie Odom Jr., who lives next door, who comes in to help. And it's basically a story about how the two sisters reconnect, how they see the world in a different way. And here's a clip.
I need 100, 100, and 500.
Did you get what I needed?
Wow, these are pretty. Which one is going to make me feel like less hostile?
Blue.
Oh.
Before we get started,
you got my money?
What does this feel like?
It's a little late.
If you don't give me what I need, then I have to do something bad. I don't want to do something bad. Do you understand?
I'm going to get your money.
Knock, knock. Surprise!
Your grandmother left these papers in case of emergency.
She didn't happen to mention a will, did she?
Dear Kazoo, there's no money. There is, however, a magical little girl, your sister. All she's got now is you.
She can understand everything you are saying to her. And if you are happy, press this.
I am sad.
Very funny, troublemaker.
She sees the world in a completely different way from us.
We're about to have a pool party.
I am happy.
And how many days clean?
30.
We'll just see about that, won't we?
Damn it.
You're on probation.
Yeah.
You can do this.
I'm gonna help her just like she helps me. And I'm actually learning how to love. Because I love her.
So that was a clip there from Music. And I think it's good to just firstly address the controversy around this film. If you've been living under a rock for the last 2 weeks, obviously very controversial in the sense that it has really offended the autism community, not just in terms of Maddie Ziegler's performance, casting a neurotypical actor who plays an autistic person, but there are two scenes in the film where they use a thing called a prone restraint, which is a method that I don't think is used anymore with autistic people, but apparently it causes real damage. The scale of LGBTQ and black, I feel like autism is so down the line a little bit, and I feel like we should come a long way since Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman. We should be a lot further ahead, but this film is like, no, we're going straight back there. Actually, we're going behind Dustin. Dustin makes it look great. This film would have benefited so much by having an actual autistic actor. It would have brought so much more authenticity, I think, to the film. However, in the context of the film, Maddie Ziegler is somebody who's a longtime collaborator of Sia. They've worked together many, many times in many music videos. And I think it's helpful to point out that the film does include these musical dance sequences within the story. And so there's a lot of choreography. There's a lot of dancing, interpretive dancing. So I don't agree with it. But in that sense, I don't think anybody should be going after Maddie Ziegler for this. It's not her fault, okay? She was cast in this. She did her job, okay? And a lot of the film is dancing and choreography, and that is her specialty. She's a dancer. She's not an actress. So I think, say what you want about Sia, lay off Maddie Ziegler because it's not her fault. And then you have the controversy around the whole prone restraint. And if you watch the film, it is so uncomfortable to watch. I mean, there's a scene where they're outdoors, I think it's Kate Hudson just pushes Maddie's to the ground. It's awful to watch. And to think that that's had real life ramifications is just so horrible to watch. I really found that hard. And again, it's so tonally deaf from Sia. And this is the issue for me. Like, I she should have done her research. She should be seeking guidance and advice from other, real autistic communities. When you do this project, like, you should be going out and, you know, talking to people with autism, talking to community groups, you know, getting a sense of, right, how am I going to portray this authentically, accurately, so people don't get offended? And I feel like she didn't do any of that. Apparently she casted an autistic actress and it was too hard work. She found it too stressful, so she just got Maddie. And I feel like she didn't spare any thought to this at all. So I totally agree with all the kind of controversy around that. However, the amount of abuse I've seen online towards Sia has been way past the line. I mean, I've seen stuff calling her a disgusting human being, saying that she should rot in hell, people sending death threats. And this isn't just on Twitter. This is on Letterboxd. These are on film sites where people have put it in their reviews. Like, they're not hiding anything. And I think whatever you feel about this film, we should not cross that line, okay? You know, I think it's good to look at examples like this and learn from it and, right, push for more inclusivity. And rather than kind of, you know, shouting back and making Sia's life absolute hell, which I'm sure it has been for the last couple of weeks, we need to go, right, we're going to look at this. This is going to be our case study now. And we're going to learn from this, right? We're going to take this example and go, right, this is an example of what not to do. Saying that, moving from the controversy, I didn't hate this film. And I know that's like a massive statement. I feel like you either hate this film or there are people that have loved it. I thought there were bits in there that I genuinely thought had promise and I had potential. For example, the cast. Listen, I don't think Kate Hudson deserves a Golden Globe for this, but I kind of liked her character. Again, you know, because of a very weak script and a lack of direction, there was just her character didn't go anywhere, but I thought she had the basics of a really interesting character there. Somebody who's a recovering alcoholic, who's trying to reconnect and get back. Like, we've seen it before, but I felt like Kate Hudson is a good actress. And I feel like if she was given a better script, she would have done better. Same, Leslie Odom Jr. He's a great actor. And there's a subplot involving him, which I thought was really interesting and just doesn't go anywhere. Like, it doesn't go anywhere at all. And I'm like, they're there. Like, the actors are there and I can see they want to do well. And it's just so disappointing. They were just not given any development. Their characters just weren't fleshed out enough. And also the message around whole love and acceptance, it just feels forced. It just feels like it's put towards the end of the film and they didn't really think about it. I don't hate this film at all. I'm completely with everybody. I think it's not a good representation. I'm against it. But I do think I can't lie and say that, oh, every single moment I hated of this film, there were moments I thought of genuine emotion there. There were moments of I could see the actors trying to get to something. I didn't sit there and I was offended by parts of it, but I didn't walk away and go, oh, I hate that. That's really riled me up like a lot of people has. But saying that, I totally get where people are coming from. Just for me, I didn't respond as harshly to it. So yeah, that's kind of what I thought of this in a nutshell.
Prepare for the hate mail.
Here we go.
Prepare for the hate mail, Dan. You said that you didn't hate it. So that immediately means...
I'm going to be cancelled. I'm going to lose my job.
You're going to get cancelled. I forget all the people sending in angry tweets about your microphone. This is all going to blow up now. I'm going to lead the show with you saying you didn't hate. Music. I didn't know about this film. I didn't know about the controversies or anything. I don't think I've ever heard a Sia song, to be honest. I'm a bit older. I'm not down with the kids. I don't know, you know, you sang a bit of a song there.
Went over your head.
Went over my head completely. It was nice, but you know, went over my head completely. So I wasn't familiar with her particularly. All the controversy until you brought it up recently. And when you brought it up, I was like, oh dear, I don't even know if we should be talking about it on the film, because I think you're right. There's this notion that we shouldn't even be discussing it. Like, I think I've seen a few critics who are like, I'm not even going to review it or watch it. And I think that's wrong in a way. I think art is art. And I think we need to at least give it a try. And how can we properly discuss the issues? How can we properly resolve these issues if we're just gonna not even address it and actually watch it and see for ourselves? There have been many films over the years, like Stanley Kubrick's, you know, Clockwork Orange, which, you know, I remember debating in school whether or not that should be allowed or banned or whatever. These films, regardless of how you feel about them or their controversies, providing it's not triggering or anything like that, then we should be at least attempting to watch and grow from it, like you rightly said. So I wasn't aware of the controversies going in. So I went in relatively open-minded. I went in thinking, I'm just going to judge it for what it is. within like 30 seconds, I was like, oh, I'm going to absolutely hate this film. Absolutely despise this film. Just by that opening like moment of Maddie Ziegler, you know, doing her thing. In terms of the controversy, going to back, like you said, to Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. Obviously, he's not autistic, but I think he gives a superb performance in that film. And just because he isn't autistic, that's not going to change my mind. I'm not going to go back and watch Rain Man, you know, in the next couple of months and go, oh, you know what? That's really offended me now. Dustin Hoffman is cancelled. And, you know, I find it really offensive. But I think you hit the nail on the head. The difference is here, he did the research. He went out and spent time, you know, with autistic people. He did his research. He was properly prepared for the role. Whereas I think Maddie Ziegler just wasn't at all. And I looked and I did some research. And apparently she researched the role by watching YouTube videos of autistic children like having fits. She said that was the extent of her research. I mean, it sounds like she did her research from her bed just watching YouTube videos.
Probably.
And I think if you go in so unprepared for this type of role, you can't then be surprised when people are like offended or say, you know, your performance is dreadful. And I think her performance is shocking. I watched it with my better half, who was equally as shocked as me. She literally turned to me and said, oh, I thought you were cringing then. I was like, I was cringing. I am physically cringing. And she raised the interesting point. Like, if you want to deal with these themes, like, make it about depression. Like, you could do the same thing, but make it about a young girl who is suffering from chronic depression. And then she has these bouts of, like, fantasy sequences, which are colourful and lovely. There were ways to tackle the same subject matter in a less offensive way. I think it is a complete misfire. I think, you know, the research wasn't there at all, like you rightly said. So I get the controversies to a degree. I honestly hated this film. I just thought the cast was dreadful. I couldn't sit through, you know, I just sat through it and I just felt awkward. I cringed the whole time. Made me feel genuinely uncomfortable. And if you said, you know, live through 2020 again or sit through this film again, I would have to have a think. I'd be like, give me 20 minutes.
That is nuts.
Honestly, what? It's one of the worst films I've seen in a long time, just because, wow. just in general, to be honest, like, forget the controversies, forget the awful performances. I just thought it was a mess. I just thought a disaster of a movie.
Well, how do you think I feel? I bought it. It's in my purchase history now. I don't know how to get it off. I've got to ring Amazon.
Well, you could revisit the music. You could maybe have that. Like, I admit, the music was.
Yeah, different. I'll skip to the music. I'll skip to the end credits. I like the song at the end.
Yeah, that's the song's quite good at the end, actually. And, you know, it's colourful. You could have it maybe in the music.
Yeah, I'll mute it. When guests are coming over, I'll be like, oh, come on in. And they'll be like, what's that on the screen? But, oh, nothing. It's just a screensaver. Moving on now, to break up the film reviews, we got to sit down and chat to Helen O'Hara. She's a film critic, author, journalist for Empire magazine, and she chatted to us all about her new book. We now have the pleasure of being joined by film journalist, critic and author Helen O'Hara, who is here today to discuss her brand new book. It's called Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. I wish I could have a copy in front of me just to show you, but it is excellent. It's available on the 18th of February to buy, so please go out and buy it. It's excellent. Helen, thank you for joining us so much. How are you today?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm good, or as good as we can be at this point in the world, you know. But, you know, I have work I can do from home, luckily, so I'm very privileged that way. And so far, people are healthy and okay. And, you know, my parents are getting their vaccines. So, you know, it's all good, really. It's
brilliant.
All
good. Oh, fantastic. I was going to ask, how has this last year been for you? Obviously, with the book, were you writing the book during lockdown, or had it been finished beforehand?
No, I was writing during lockdown, and it was a real problem because, of course, until lockdown, I had spent virtually every day in the BFI library, you know, which has an incredible collection of film books and old magazines and newspapers and everything. And suddenly that entire resource was completely cut off. So I had to do the second half of the book much more from online sources and whatever I could order from, you know, online bookstores and everything else. So luckily I'd done the kind of historical stuff mostly by that point, but it didn't make it any easier, no.
Oh, you pushed through, Helen. We love that. So like I said, you're here today to discuss your brand new book. It's called Women vs. Hollywood. What inspired you to write the book? Obviously, a lot has happened recently in terms of different movements here when it comes to women in film. What inspired you particularly to think, right, this year I'm going to write this book?
I mean, I have to confess, it's something that I've written about and talked about a lot on various podcasts and in Empire. And, you know, I used to write for a women's kind of website magazine called The Pool. And we discussed a lot of these issues there, but I wasn't really thinking about it in terms of a book until I talked to my now editor, Amanda, who is also a film journalist in her own right, and I got to know her that way. Didn't actually know she did books, and then we got talking about this stuff, and really the idea kind of grew out of that. So it was kind of an attempt for me to understand exactly why we got to the situation we're in, where over 80% of directors of big movies are men. Most films have male leads. Again, it's I think over 80% most years. And women's stories seemed perpetually to be put on the back seat. So why is that? Because in history, there have been times when it was better. You know, there were better films for female leads in the 40s, and there were more women directors and certainly more women writers in the silent era. So how come we're in this position we're in now? So it was really an attempt for me to kind of explain that almost to myself, let alone anybody else.
It's quite interesting, actually, because like you said, you mentioned there that there were a lot of women, especially in the silent era, who were working on films. And I think that's the interesting thing about the title of the book, is that it's the fall and rise of women in film. And I think a lot of people, me included, would sort of assume that this has always been the case since day one, since, you know, film was invented, that women had no place in Hollywood, and, you know, they served their role as, you know, lead actresses and things like that, but that was the extent of it. But what I loved about the book is that it actually talks about these trailblazers, really, in the silent era, who were at the forefront of this filmmaking. So without spoiling too much about the book, can you tell us a little bit about that and how much you knew about these women yourself before writing the book?
Yeah, I knew a few of them just from work I'd done, you know, previously, but not all by any means. And I had to do a lot of research, especially on the silent era, to catch up on this stuff. Basically, there was nobody in the silent era, in the very early silent era, at least, to tell you you couldn't. So if you had a bit of cash and you could afford like a camera and some cutting equipment, you could basically make movies. And so you had these women who were there going out, setting up their own studios, directing, producing, writing. There was no real definition of roles necessarily. So some of them just did everything, you know, and they had their own places to do it. So you get people like Alice Guy Blaschet and Lois Weber, who were incredibly powerful at the time. They were never a majority. I don't want to give the wrong idea. They weren't a majority of cinema owners or studio makers or whatever else, but they were there. And they were about 50% of screenwriters by some estimates, which is way more than we have now. So in some degrees, we kind of have gone back from that time. But it is extraordinary when you look these up. There's a website online. It's called the Women Film Pioneers Project. It's run by Columbia University. They are the real scholars on this. They have assembled biographies and details of hundreds of women who were doing virtually every job in the silent era. And it's extraordinary just to think, I mean, these women barely had the right to vote for most of their working lives, and they were still making movies. So it's really just kind of trying to bring some of those stories back into the spotlight. You know, there were action serials led by women. There were women jumping off trains and out of balloons and stuff. Yeah, it's kind of cool to think that the potential is there and the room is there in cinema. We just have to kind of claim it back.
Absolutely. And what I found really interesting about it was, I mean, I remember my studies back in university, and I think anybody who goes through film studies will hear about D.W. Griffith and Birth of a Nation. But like you said yourself, there are all these filmmakers like Alice Guy and Lois Weber who I can't remember ever learning about during my entire kind of education within film studies. So do you think there's a problem there as well about kind of educating these, you know, up and coming filmmakers and film critics and film journalists about these women?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they were written out of history. I mean, it's not your professor's fault necessarily, because literally Alice Guy, for a long time in her career, worked for Gaumont, the big French studio, and they literally didn't include her in the official history of Gaumont, you know. So there was this attempt to just kind of brush over this whole part of Hollywood history and just kind of move away from it. And so you really have to dig for a lot of this stuff. And that's what the Women Film Pioneers Project has done to kind of get all of this together. And yeah, I do think it's important to talk about this because I think it changes the way we discuss film. And it also is important to talk more about, you know, female directors in more modern times, because they have begun to kind of fight back and push back for a place. And that shouldn't just be something that you study in a particular feminist film module. You shouldn't have to actively choose that. You know, that should be built in the same way that, you know, Black filmmakers and Asian filmmakers, it should all be kind of part of the conversation. Because, you know, I love that Roger Ebert quote. I use it a lot, about cinema being an empathy machine. But if we only talk about the white straight men, let's be honest, then that's only having empathy for a tiny portion of the people who are A, making films, and B, you know, featured in films.
Bringing things up to modern day now, you touch upon the Me Too movement quite a bit in the book, which is obviously a real watershed movement in the industry. You say in the book that they've still got a long way to go. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I mean, most of the power structures are still in place. The people who, you know, the Harvey Weinsteins, let's be honest, the grotesque abusers have hopefully been removed, and many of them will stay away, I hope. But others, you know, sort of accused of lesser offences, some who admitted to it, were back and working within no time at all. And the structures where mostly men are in these positions of power and mostly women come into the business, you know, very young and are vulnerable to abuse, that's still the case. And there isn't necessarily yet the full cultural shift so that those young people can be assured of being taken seriously if they complain, you know, against a more powerful person. And we see this, it's not just Hollywood, we see this in industries all over the world. I'm not saying, and this is one of the things leveled against the Me Too movement, which is kind of a straw man argument. No one's saying that once you're accused of something, your career should be over and your life should be ruined. That's not the point. The point is accusations like this should be taken seriously. They should be investigated. They shouldn't be brushed under the rug. There should be some way of holding powerful, usually men, to account for these things. And that's what the movement's really asking for. And that's what we still don't really have. So I do think there's a long way to go. But I think that the Me Too movement showed the scale of the problem, and it showed that people will sometimes at least pay attention to it. And I think it also created a lot of solidarity among women and kind of made women realize how big the problem was, that they weren't alone, that they weren't the only victims, and encouraged them to maybe work a bit harder for each other. So I hope that will help.
How hopeful are you for the future, Helen, with all of this you've just discussed there, that we've got a bit of way to go? Obviously, you know, you had movements like Me Too, which I feel like for people who haven't studied film, who haven't been surrounded by that, that really hit them in particular, because I feel like those in their teens and their early 20s, that was something that really hit them prior to that. So how hopeful are you of the future? Are we making a big enough steps, or is there still quite a long way to go?
There's a really long way to go, but I do think we're beginning to head in the right direction. It all comes down to numbers, right? It's show business, not show art, really. And we're beginning to see some of those old myths that people don't want to watch films about women, that people don't want to watch superheroines, that people don't want to watch female-led action movies or whatever. Those are being taken apart by the market. You know, women are going to see those things. Men are going to see those things. Those things are making money. And that is making a big change. Films directed by women are being hits and blockbusters in the recent past, and that's going to change things. Those old excuses that we can't find women to hire for these jobs, you know, we don't have a choice, we have to hire men, those are falling apart because women have set up these databases of other women you can hire. And, you know, Ava DuVernay's database as well, not just women, but all underrepresented groups. So there's no excuse for saying, well, I couldn't find any, you know, cinematographers of color, or I couldn't find any gay composers or whatever else. You know, those people are out there and they are findable. And if you're not finding them, that's because you're not looking. So all of these kind of resources, all of these things are responses to a realization that we do have an unequal picture, and that there is money to be made as well as moral strength in doing the right thing. Even if you don't care about doing the right thing, even if you think it's all social justice warriordom or whatever the term is, then it's also the sensible thing to do. It's also the money-making thing to do. It's also the economic thing to do. And I think that is the thing, sadly, that's going to change the picture, not the moral argument. They don't care about that, but the money they care about. And I think that's beginning to shift as well. It will take time and it will take sustained attention from the world, but I do think we're shifting in the right direction.
Definitely. And finally, obviously, it's been a very strange and unpredictable year. I feel like we all deserve a medal for just surviving this last year. Yeah. In particular, you, Helen, because you've written a book in lockdown, so you deserve two medals.
Well, you know what? I do a lot of races, and I only do the ones that have good medals, so I'm 100% up for this. It sounds great.
Definitely. And finally, what's next for you, Helen? Do you plan on writing another book? Are you focusing more on Empire magazine? Kind of, what's next for you?
I don't have any plans for another book at the moment because this one, just by the time I got to the end of it, I was literally emailing my editor going, never again, no, no more. So, never say never, but certainly not immediate plans for another one. And so I'm mostly doing things like the Empire podcast at the moment. We have that every week. We also do the Empire spoiler podcast, which at the moment is keeping us busy with like WandaVision conspiracy theories and things like that, which I'm very much enjoying. And just trying to kind of get my head back on and you know, read some books that aren't about film, because I basically spent a year and a half only reading film books.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Much as I love them and much as I've learned an enormous amount, I'm very much enjoying this fiction. Have you heard of fiction? Yes, I'm enjoying fiction. So yeah, a little bit more of that before I do anything else.
It's nice. A nice break. Definitely. thank you so much, Helen. It's been a genuine pleasure. And we just want to say, as a show, we champion female-led films. We champion female directors and film. You can look at all of our past shows. You know, we're big on diversity and inclusion, and not just that, LGBTQ Black stories. So it's been a pleasure talking to you. Your new book, Women vs. Hollywood, is out 18th of February. Go and buy it, everybody. Even if shops aren't physically open, order it online. It's excellent. So thank you so much, Helen.
Cheers. Lovely talking to you.
And that was our interview there with Helen O'Hara. What an absolute pleasure it was to chat with her. I think she might be my favourite interview. One of my favourites.
We don't have favourites. But yeah.
One of my favourites.
Yeah. She's definitely up there. Helen O'Hara is definitely up there in terms of favourite interviews for sure. And the book is great. And that's genuine. You know, sometimes... it's awkward sometimes when you've got to interview people and you're like, it's a really, really great, you know, and you've got to kind of dance around the fact that maybe the content isn't as great as you would have liked. But it was lovely to actually sit down and read the book over that weekend before the interview. And actually really genuinely enjoyed it. So it's out now, and genuinely, you might think you know everything there is to know about women in Hollywood, but this book will definitely throw a few surprises in there. So definitely seek it out.
Absolutely. Getting back to films now, we've got two more for you. The first of which, Joe, you've managed to see. It's called Judas and the Black Messiah. You were very looking forward to this one, weren't you?
I was very excited. Like, the trailer for this film is absolutely incredible. It's one of the best trailers that I've seen in a long, long time. And it's one of those films which just felt like it was made for me, you know? It felt like it had ticked all the boxes for me. This stars Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. Jesse Plemons also stars, and Dominique Fishback. And this is a true story here about two people, Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who is a con artist. We see him at the beginning of the film. He's pretending to be an FBI agent just so that he can steal a car. He gets quickly caught. He gets pulled over by the police, and Jesse Plemons, FBI agent, approaches him and says, look, you know, we want you to infiltrate the Black Panther Party, get close to Fred Hampton, who is posing a serious threat to America. And it's all about this sort of Departed style story about Bill O'Neill becoming close to Fred Hampton and the ultimate betrayal, which happens at the end of the film. Here's a clip.
Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton of the Illinois Black Panther Party.
Repeat after me.
Revolutionary! You're looking at 18 months for the stolen car, 5 years for impersonating a federal officer, or you can go home.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror.
I will learn all that I can.
These ain't no terrorists.
You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
So going into this, I had no idea about the story behind it. I was very, very excited nonetheless to watch it. The film itself is riveting, it's compelling, and you've got these incredible central performances at the heart of the film, especially Daniel Kakula, who, you know, practically breathes fire on screen. Like, he is so good in this movie. There's this whole speech which is featured predominantly in the trailer, and it is just one of those moments where you're like, cinema. Cinema.
C'est bon.
Yeah. Oh, cinema. It's pure cinema. And I think the performances are probably the best thing about the film by the end of it. It is a fascinating story, one which, like I said, I wasn't familiar with. And I think it'll be the same for a lot of people. I think a lot of people won't be familiar with the story. And I think it deserves its time in the limelight. It deserves its, you know, shot on the big screen. And I think it's a shocking story. You kind of watch it and you're like, this is a bit like Scorsese's The Departed, but it's an actual true story. But my main gripe with it, and the reason why I kind of came out of it not loving it as much as I thought I was going to, because I thought this is going to be a pure 5-star. I mean, maybe my expectations were too high, but I was going in like, this is going to be like one of the films of the year right now. But I left kind of feeling a bit unfulfilled, because the impression I got from the trailer was that this was going to be a film about two men kind of becoming brothers, which ultimately ends in a massive betrayal, you know, as the title implies, Judas and the Black Messiah. You know, we all know Judas was a bad boy. I was kind of hoping for more of a relationship between these two characters building through the film to the point where they are brothers, which would have kind of added to the tension and added to that kind of heartbreak at the end of the film. The film is, you know, nonetheless heartbreaking, but still that relationship through the film wasn't there. And I was kind of surprised by that. And I kind of wondered why. But after the press screening, there was a Q&A with the filmmakers. And they basically said that the kind of whole reasoning behind that aspect, initially they wanted, and I think they were going to go down that route of kind of developing this relationship between these two characters. But Shaka King approached, obviously, and we're going back to research and getting people involved. They approached Fred Hampton's son, his real life son. And the son said two things. If you're going to make this film, I want to be clear that Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, was never my father's security guard, you know, bodyguard. He was never his bodyguard. Secondly, they were never friends, because my father never trusted him enough to be close with him. So if you honor those, I've got no problem with you making the film. So I feel like Shaka King and the filmmakers were kind of in a box then. They didn't really have much of a creative control. They couldn't kind of maybe, for dramatic purposes, build a kind of a creative faux relationship between the two characters. So I get the reasoning behind it. But for me, you know, I would have liked if the film had maybe had more of creative flair. As it stands, I think it is powerful. Obviously, it's very current still, which is shocking considering the time difference. And it is just a film full of rage and fire and fury, and the performances are terrific. And I do need to give a shout out to all the cast, not just the two central leads. I mean, you've got Jesse Plemons, who, I mean, since Game Night, has just been incredible. And he's just been announced, funnily enough, as the lead in Martin Scorsese's new movie. And like to see him taking a lead role in a Scorsese movie is great. But Dominique Fishback, who plays Deborah Johnson, she is outstanding. She plays like the love interest, but you know, I say that as if she's one-dimensional. She's not, she's very three-dimensional, and she is kind of like the heart and soul of the movie. So it's a film filled with great performances. It is tense, it is full of rage, it is important, but it didn't quite have that same emotional punch that I was expecting going in. But I'm looking forward to watching it again and seeing if that changes.
Oh, brilliant, mate. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And it is on PVOD for people to watch. They're not sleeping on this when they're letting people watch it, which is
yeah, great. And fair play to Warner Brothers. They're not kind of holding back. And they've been great at that. They've been the one studio, regardless of how we feel about HBO Max, they've been the one studio which should go in, we're not going to hang fire. Let's just put it out. So yeah, it is available to watch from today. So check it out.
Brilliant. And our final film for today's show is a real cracker. This is I Care a Lot, starring the one and only Rosamund Pike, who we do care a lot about, don't we? We love Rosamund.
We do.
Ever since Die Another Day, we love her. I'm sure she's going to hate me referring that, but there we are. This is directed by Jay Blakeson, who directed The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which I really loved back in the day, with that kind of propelled Gemma Arterton into what she is now. And this is a story. I thought this was based on a true story, but thank goodness it's not. And this is stars Rosamund Pike as a very crooked legal guardian. She has a business where basically she has a lot of friends in higher places, such as doctors, medical specialists. They basically say that an elderly person cannot look after themselves. They need a legal guardian. She steps in. She escorts them to a nursing home. She sells off their property and all their possessions, and she keeps the money for herself. So quite a nasty woman. And Rosamund Pike plays these characters so well, a really nasty, manipulative person. However, she meets her match when one of her elderly people isn't exactly who she says she is. Here's a clip.
You hold stock in Golden Light Care Homes, right?
Yeah, we have a chunk.
Sign some over to me. Come on. I'm helping you feed the money monster, but I hardly see any of the gold for myself. Give me a taste.
Done. But it has to be a real cherry, bona fide.
Jennifer Peterson.
She's in reasonably good health, but recently she has shown some signs of memory loss and confusion.
Significant.
No, but we can tickle that to make an emergency hearing go our way. She has no kids, no husband, no living family.
No family at all.
She has very good insurance. She told me she used to work in finance in Chicago and moved here to retire.
Can I get a copy of all this?
You bet. I'll accept her test results. That wouldn't be ethical.
So that was a clip there from I Care a Lot. This is over on Netflix in America, but we've got it on Amazon Prime this week. And I'm going to say right now, favorite film of the year so far, 5 stars. I absolutely loved this film from start to finish. Firstly, Rosamund Pike, so underrated. I feel like she still hasn't quite reached her kind of potential. And this film is going to propel her, I think. She's giving me Gone Girl vibes in this one. She is somebody. She plays a woman who is, on the surface, very suave, sophisticated, actually quite charming in a way, and really kind of somebody who is powerful. And then beneath that, she plays a really cold-blooded, toxic, really horrible woman that will stop at nothing just to make a lot of money and be the top of her league. She refers to herself as a lioness, and I couldn't agree more. And Rosamund Pike is the perfect person to play this role. She encapsulates that kind of that manipulativeness and that really, really kind of deliciously, you know, really nasty traits of her character. I thought she was just absolutely excellent in this. And it's funny because through the course of the film, and I don't want to spoil anything, She starts off on top and then she gets kind of taken down. But, you know, it's a really, really testament to her as an actress that I both hated her and loved her at the same time. Like, I thought I sympathized her at points, which I shouldn't be, because she is supposed to be quite an unlikable character. But, you know, that's a testament to her. You know, the script is so good and she's such a good actress that, yeah, I just found her absolutely excellent in this. And again, you have somebody, Jay Blixon, who he paces the film so well. It starts off as one thing and ends in a completely different direction. It's a roller coaster of events that never ceases. The film is 2 hours long and you are on the edge of your seat for every single moment. You have no idea what's going to happen. It's such a darkly comical, riveting thriller. It balances the comedy and kind of the seriousness of it so, so well. And I think at the end of it, if you really look into it, it is a film that is commenting on the elderly, on how vulnerable they are, on how these big corporations are taking advantage of them for their own selfish greed. That's what I love the most about this film. You know, fun aside, it has a real message to deliver. And I just thought it did it effortlessly. I absolutely love this film. I'm really surprised if it's not my top 10 at the end of the year, or even top 5. I loved it so much, honestly. And it's a shame that Rosamund Pike isn't getting any noms for this. She should do. And again, you know, it's not just her. I think the cast are absolutely great. You've got Peter Dinklage here, who we love.
Yeah, we do.
Again, playing a very menacing gangster. And, you know, you wouldn't think it, but he really is in this. And Eliza Gonzalez, who we know from Bloodshot from last year.
That classic Bloodshot. Yeah.
And she plays her love interest. And I just love how that's included in the film. It's just not like they don't even really pay that much attention to it. They treat it as if she had a husband or a man in the film. Yeah. And I love it. I thought that was done. And the ending, oh my gosh, so shocking, so bold. And I just love this film so much. What do you think?
I am not surprised, first and foremost, that you loved it. I just knew, I just had that feeling that you were going to love it. And that's because we've talked about Rosamund Pike a lot. Obviously, I think since Hostiles, really, was when we first started kind of your love for Rosamund Pike really kind of came to fruition. And we really talked about it a lot. I know you've seen her in Gone Girl and stuff beforehand, but I remember when Hostiles came out and that was your film of that year, I think. And you were talking about how brilliant she was in that film. And I totally agree with you. She is just one of the most understated brilliant actors of this time. I think Gone Girl has kind of been the film which she's had the most attention for, not Die Another Day, which is a shame. But yeah, Gone Girl seems to be the most attention she's ever had had in a film. And I think that's wrong, because she gives these incredible performances and she's not afraid to take risks and mix things up. The last film I remember seeing her in before this was Radioactive last year, where she played Marie Curie, and that was a very safe, very BBC drama where she's kind of playing it straight, and you know, she's great at that. But then she's not afraid to play these roles where, like you said, they're three-dimensional. She's not very nice at all, but you kind of vie for her to win anyway, and that's because of her performance. And I think the film does that really, really well. You have these deplorable characters all through it. There's not a nice character in this film, really. And it kind of plays with your emotions. You're kind of there going, who do I want to win? Who do I want to come out on top at the end of it? And for a film to have that notion, challenge you in that way, I think is brilliant. The writing is sharp. It's dark. It's very dark kind of comedy. And I think it's quite ironic that Peter Dinklage is in it, because it sort of reminded me of the tone of like In Bruges a bit, like really dark, but it's got that like comedy to it as well. So I thought it was great, very well written, very well performed. Didn't love it. I've seen better films this year, but I think, you know, it's something a bit different. It's got that black humor to it, which I love. And Rosamund Pike, like you said, you know, it's a crime that she hasn't really been up for much for this, because she is worth watching for it alone.
Absolutely, yeah. And I Care a Lot is available now on Amazon Prime, so go and check it out. Almost the end of the show now this week, but we're going to do a little segment, Joe. He's going to love this. He's going to love it. And it's a new segment we like to call Two Truths and a Lie.
That's going to be the theme tune.
Yeah, Joe's going to put a great theme tune onto that.
Yeah, it's literally going to be that.
So this takes Joe back to first year uni in his pre-drinks flat when they used to, you know, like, used to do like, oh, would you rather?
This would is you, what?
You know,
where did I go to uni? Where did I go to uni? Would you rather? Do they...
Liverpool. So this is a game, Two Truths and a Lie. I've got three facts, Joe, about this week's new releases. Two are true, one is a lie. Okay. And you've just got to decide which is the lie. Simples. Okay. So you're ready.
Okay.
Simples. So fact one, Kate Hudson shaved her entire head for her role in Sears Music. She shaved her career as well, but let's put that.
She definitely did.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Okay. Fact two, the Wrong Turn remake, which we've discussed on the show, is only the second Wrong Turn film to be released theatrically.
Mm.
And finally, fact three, Rosamund Pike in I Care A Lot initially was supposed to have a British accent, but after convincing director Jay Blakeson, he allowed her to change it for the role. Okay, so those are your three facts. Which is the lie? Is it Kate Hudson shaving her hair? Is it Wrong Turn being the only second film to be released theatrically out of the series? Or is it Rosamund Pike was going to do a British accent and then, director wanted to do a British accent and she changed it?
I think it's the Wrong Turn, which is the lie. I think Wrong Turn probably did okay back in the day. I think Wrong Turn maybe, I'm probably like digging myself a grave here, but I think Wrong Turn probably did enough in the day. It was probably low budget, probably made a decent buck. So they at least released, I think, Wrong Turn 2 theatrically. That's my guess.
Okay. All right. Well, I can now reveal that you are wrong.
What?
That's great. That shows that I'm really good at this now.
Yeah.
The lie was, in fact, Rosamund Pike.
Okay.
Always had American accent. Her name is Marla Grace.
You did good. You did good. The Rosamund Pike one was so convoluted that I just naturally assumed that was the lie, which you made up.
Well, there we are. Well, there we are. That's Two Truths and a Lie. Thank you for playing. We're going to give you a free Dan and Joe Film Show mug for you and some toilet roll too.
Should we offer that to our guests going forward?
Yeah, okay. Definitely. 100%. They can have a free mug and some toilet roll with our little faces on it.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. Even when you're on the toilet and you're just like, oh, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we're not good enough. But that is the end of today's show. It's been a cracker of one. It's been a jam-packed show, as always. But the fun doesn't stop here, guys. You can listen to all our old episodes if you want. We're on Mixcloud, Spotify. We're on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. Just type in the Dan and Joe Film Show. You can also find us on social media. We're on Facebook under the Dan and Joe Film Show and on Twitter and Instagram at DJ Film Show. That's at DJ Film Show. Let us know what you've seen this week. If you've seen any of the new releases, get in touch. We'd love to read you out live on our episodes. Joe, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's always a pleasure. And I'm going to actually get dressed now.
Yeah,
in the shower.
So you go
you'll
do
be
that.
Very pleased.
I can smell. I can smell the morning stench from here. It's quite erotic, actually. I quite like it.
Yeah.
And again, thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on the Dan and Joe Film Show. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.